Means, Subcommittee on Public Safety. Colleagues, today is March 16, 2015. We're convened for the purposes of public hearing on Senate Bill 5504, the budget bill for the Oregon Department of Corrections. Linda, would you like to tee anything up for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Department of Corrections will be here for 3 days doing a high-level overview, and on the fourth day, Thursday, there will be public testimony. And along all these lines, next Monday, you will not have a meeting here in order to allow time to go to Coffee Creek for field work. Department of Corrections will come back for phase two to make a little bit deeper dive into packages and details. I will note that the governor's budget is based on an October 2014 prison population forecast. The budget that you recommend as a subcommittee will be based on the April forecast, which will be out very soon. And if that's all, I believe Director Peters is prepared.
Let's get going.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Williamson and Shields, and members of the committee. It really is a pleasure to be able to kickstart this week off with all of you. We are very excited to share some information about the Department of Corrections. For the record, I am Colette Peters. I am the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, and we have a lot to cover in the next few days, but we're excited to share the work that we've engaged in since we've last met a biennium ago. I do want to start by saying how incredibly proud I am of this team. The team that spreads from across the state, and some of them will be represented and sit before you this week. But it really is an organization that has been moving since I last presented our budget to you 2 years ago. It's an organization that has really been progressive in some of its change and focus, and so we're thrilled to be able to spend some time with you talking about that. And we have some new individuals. Most notably, we have a new deputy director in our agency for the first time in 11 years. And that is quite the change. Many of you know her. Kim Brokamp is our new deputy director, but we also have two new assistant directors. So our executive team is really coming together now as we prepare for 2015. I have actually been the director of the Department of Corrections now for 3 years. And in many ways, it seems like much longer than that. And in others, it's been a very quick 3 years. But the team has really accomplished so much in those 3 years, and we're going to share many of those accomplishments today. We continue to operate one of the best correctional systems in the country, and that's evidenced by a number of key indicators, including the fact that we have one of the lowest recidivism rates in the country. Our violence rate is actually down in Oregon, and it has always been less than in other parts of the country. We've also tried to become more efficient. We've implemented a performance-based management system, which we hope will do many things, but most important to you, I think, is to really increase your confidence in the Department of Corrections appropriation. We've managed to keep those statistics in the face of major budget reductions, as you are all aware of. And all the while, we have become the largest mental health provider in the state. And we are also managing a rapidly growing aging and geriatric population. It was if I had planned that statement when Senator Bates came in.
I'm rapidly aging and becoming geriatric. Thank you very much, Mrs. Peters.
No, that is not
what I was looking at you.
Yeah. Oh, give me.
That I know we've had many conversations about. And it hasn't just been those challenges. We've also experienced those successes while managing 964 temporary and emergency beds, which, as you know, has created difficult prison operations. There's no doubt about it. So how did we do that? We have very experienced and dedicated staff. I cannot walk the halls of our prisons without meeting individuals who are thrilled to be there, who are talking about innovation, who are feeling empowered, and are actually engaging in their work. We also, as you know, use evidence-based practices. We know so much more about corrections than we did 20 years ago, and we use those best practices to engage in our case planning, our criminal risk assessments, both in prison and the community. And I think it's that circular use of that research that really helps us tout those statistics. And we have a strong oversight mechanism through the Office of the Inspector General. Now, since the last time I was before you in this official capacity of presenting our budget, we also passed public safety reform. So instead of coming before you today asking to open the Deer Ridge Correctional Facility in Madras or having to build Junction City, I'm here to tell you about the innovative and progressive things that we have going on in our agency and as the public safety system as a whole in Oregon. And I think we all can be proud of that. So as I mentioned, we have an enormous amount of information to get through over the coming days. This is our tentative schedule for the week. This here is the table of contents for your reference. But I do want to start with the agency overview. So the mission of the Oregon Department of Corrections is to promote public safety by holding offenders accountable and working to reduce the risk of future criminal behavior. Now, the first part of that mission is something that we've really refined over the years. We know how to hold offenders accountable. But I think even that goes beyond removing them from society and putting them away for a specific period of time. It really is about holding them accountable for their personal actions. And it's about helping inmates acknowledge and take responsibility for those actions, both their behavior outside in the community and inside our prison walls. Now, the second half of our mission is to reduce the likelihood that individuals will commit another crime after release. As a former victim's advocate, that piece is so important so that we ensure that another victim is not created when that individual goes back to the community. And what we do really in corrections is echoed in the Oregon Constitution. First and foremost, we protect public safety. That's the most important element. Secondly, as the Constitution speaks to, we hold those offenders accountable. And third, we allow for rehabilitation and reformation. We know that people can change. Part of our success depends on the implementation of our business strategy, which you are all familiar with. It's our Oregon accountability model. The OAM consists of these six separate elements that do stand alone, but when they are wound together, like they are at the Oregon Department of Corrections, it really provides for a foundation for success. And it's really about success for offenders from the time they enter our custody until the day they are released into the community. The business strategy is unique, like all of Oregon. We do things different in corrections, and it's implemented by those great staff, those 4,500 team members that I mentioned earlier, and they really do engage in a unique way. We do not hire guards. We hire officers and corrections professionals that we ask to actually engage with these adults in custody, and we talk about the three R's. We ask our staff to role model for the adults in custody, to redirect their behavior, and to treat them respectfully. And I think when many of you have been inside our prison walls, but when you visit Coffee Creek next week, you will certainly see that for yourself. So while our business philosophy remains the same as the last time we met, we have added another system that really complements this philosophy, and that is our performance-based management system. Over the last 3 years, we have worked to really implement this. Now, we talked about this last time, but it was still just in the vision stage of implementation. We have named the system CORE. That acronym stands for Correctional Outcomes Through Research and Engagement. So this is exactly what we did when I was director of the OIA. We developed a full review of the agency operations, and if you see the attachment that you have been given. I think originally we gave you a very tiny map, and today you see one that you can actually read. You don't need to get too engaged at the detail, but just understanding the mass of this $1.6 billion organization. I think this map allows you to begin to see how fully we looked at every part of our business operations. And through this review and this mapping of our organization, now we can see clearly where our operations are efficient, where they're not, And we're looking at everything, the traditional things that you all think of as public safety subcommittee members, recidivism, staff assaults, how safe are our prisons. But as we look at running a $1.6 billion organization, we also have to look at things like how long it takes our IT requests to move through, how many medication errors do we have every month. And so this fundamental map really keeps us focused on those issues. And we'll talk about that in more detail. We also developed a set of strong core values, which you can see highlighted in the map. And they support our business strategy that we talked about. They support our mission. They speak to integrity and professionalism, things you would expect from a public safety agency, dignity and respect. Safety and wellness. You're going to hear a lot more from me around the safety and wellness aspect of the Department of Corrections. It includes fact-based decision-making, positive change, honoring our history, and stewardship. So then behind this map, we actually created an agency scorecard to track the process measures on our fundamentals map, where we have established and where we have established targets, where those measures are in the yellow and red, we actually discuss those at a quarterly target review. So we have pulled an executive management team together of about 160 people from across the organization, in prison, in community corrections. It includes our policy group, our superintendents, assistant superintendents, division administrators, and then folks who are now considered our core specialists, and we actually review this data. When needed, we put a problem-solving team in place to figure out how we can get from red to yellow to green. And as we move through our presentation this time, you will see that we've included CORE throughout the whole of our presentation, and we'll actually highlight some of our measurements in the scorecard during our presentation. Now that the fundamentals map is complete, our scorecard has been developed. And as I said, QTRs are underway. We've actually already now engaged in 6 quarterly target reviews. And we are focusing our attention now on developing breakthrough initiatives. What are those strategic initiatives that impact the agency wide, have that agency wide impact that we want to focus on? And that's what this map shows you, the timeline of managing our breakthrough initiatives between now and 2017. So you'll hear more about many of these breakthrough initiatives throughout the presentation. For now, I would like to share our top agency breakthrough initiative. And as I've met with all of you individually, you all know it's my greatest worry, and that is staff wellness. When I was appointed director 3 years ago, we had 4 staff suicides in less than an 18-month period. And my doctor friends tell me that in the community of 4,500 people, that would be considered an epidemic. So unfortunately, they have continued. So we asked PSU and OHSU to come in and to study wellness, both from a physical standpoint and a mental health standpoint. So PSU came in and looked at it from a mental health standpoint. And what they found was that our staff are in a state of hypervigilance. And I think you all can appreciate that. I think those of you with a public safety background certainly can appreciate the stress around that notion. They learned that 1 in 3 of our staff members have symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. That's higher than individuals in law enforcement, firefighters, even those in active military duty. And that certainly surprised me. What that means is higher levels of anxiety and depression, which you know means more alcohol use, more divorcing, and dying young. So OHSU came in and said, how is this impacting them physically? And they actually conducted a physical assessment of over 200 of my officers in the valley. And they learned that they had high triglycerides, high cholesterol, 90% had hypertension or prehypertension. And while 73% of the country is obese, 93% of my staff studied were. And so I want to tell you a little bit about when I was listening to Dr. Carrie Keel. And one of the things that jumped out at me personally was the importance of sleeping more than 6 hours a night. And the majority of those staff studied weren't, and neither was your director. One of the things that really jumped out at me is that while I would get home, manage the family, get everyone to sleep, work until midnight, and then get up at 4:30 in the morning to get to the gym, right? Because that's what we're supposed to do. I might as well have been getting up and smoking a pack of cigarettes, according to Dr. Keel. And so I share that story because a lot of this is around educating our staff on what's important. And so while this is one of my biggest concerns, we really are working hard to combat this issue. I want to point out this is not an issue specific to Oregon. When I presented this data nationally to my colleagues, one, they weren't surprised. They had attended the funerals. They had counseled through the divorces. They had decertified because of the DUIs. But they hadn't studied it. And so we're getting some attention nationally. I serve as a member of the National Institute of Corrections Advisory Board and have been appointed now the chair on its subcommittee on wellness. In addition, the American Correctional Association has created a committee on healthy culture. I serve as the chair of that committee, and Michael Gower, our assistant director responsible for prison operations, is also a member. So I hope through these efforts we'll gain additional research and action on this very important issue and one that is near and dear to my heart. This organizational chart.
Just a moment, Senator Bates.
Please.
Thank you. Could you get the PSU study to us? I'd like to read it.
Certainly.
Okay.
Thank you.
And, I'm particularly concerned about work hours and work shifts. We have a similar problem sometimes in hospital settings with nurses working abnormal shifts and being called back in on their shifts. I don't know if that's part of this program or not. And especially if someone's working a night shift, they stay on it routinely for a long time. They do pretty well, but constantly changing back and forth is a real stressor. Probably alcohol becomes the fallback drug for most people coming off shift. I don't know if that's the case here, and some of it starts seeping into being used when they're working also. I would love to see that study if you get it to me.
Co-Chair, Senator Bates, certainly we'll make sure that you have that study. You're hitting on a key point, and I'll share a quick story with you. A couple of months ago, I ran into a staff member at Coffee Creek, a new fit and trim officer who talked about wellness and said, "We so appreciate your efforts. We're talking about it in the prison. We're getting out and walking around the perimeter rather than just sitting on our breaks. I believe that you believe in wellness, so thank you for your efforts, but my wife doesn't believe you." And I said, "Okay, tell me more." And he said, "For the last 4 days, I had to pull a mandatory overtime." And so you understand the issue, Senator, and it is something. There are lots of things that are inherent to working in corrections that don't speak to wellness. So we even have to overcompensate for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, Director, if you wouldn't mind getting the study to Linda Gilbert, and then she can distribute it to the rest of us.
Perfect, Mr. Co-Chair. We will do that. Now, this organizational chart provides just a high-level overview of the 4,500 staff members that we have in this organization, many of whom fall under five divisions, most of whom fall underneath the operations division. And Mr. Michael Gower is behind me here, ready to present on his division after I finish. We also have 7 work units outside of these divisions who actually report directly to the director's office, and that's that first row there. So you're going to learn about the 5 divisions throughout this week. Today, I will share the contributions of these 7 work units outside of those divisions. So research and projects. As a former research associate, I think once a researcher, always a researcher, I believe that research should really drive our policy decisions, not explain them on the back end. Especially in these times of scarce resources, I think it's ever more important for taxpayers to focus on research-based programs and services to really ensure that our taxpayer dollars are spent wisely and effectively. And as I said earlier, we know so much more about what works in corrections today than we did 20 years ago. So about 5 years ago, I was director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and Max Williams was in this chair, and we decided to begin a shared research resource model. And so we joined the research teams of OIA, DOC, and the Criminal Justice Commission. And I think that that really has allowed us to advance many of our research efforts. I think it was a model that was incredibly important during our conversations around public safety reform. So, Office of the Chief Financial Officer. I have our CFO sitting to my left, Rick Crager. This office has really been the guiding force that has managed through the last 10 years of an incredibly difficult budget climate. So I'm pleased to have our new CFO here with me today, and publicly would like to thank him and his team for all of their efforts. The Office of the CFO is really responsible for determining the resources necessary to support the inmate population, to develop our biennial budget, develop the fiscal impact information for any proposals the agency may wish to come forward with, any of the proposals that you push out there, and developing the fiscal impact pricing on any bill that might have a potential impact on our agency. Diversity inclusion. This is a, and I keep wanting to switch slides, I apologize. This is a new creation within existing resource. The Office of Diversity and Inclusion was created and was actually created because I believe that it's every leader's responsibility to hire the best and the brightest. That's what we want to do in state government. But I believe as the first female director, that bar is raised for me. And it's raised even further because we incarcerate a disproportionate number of minorities in our system. And the research tells us that you're more likely to engage in reformation and change if you can connect with the person that you're working with. And so we're working really hard to improve our recruitment, our succession planning, and promotion for women and minorities in this agency. And I would like to thank Gary Sims, who manages this office and is really bringing the vision. I did it again. Sit. The Government Efficiencies and Communications Office. Elizabeth Craig is here today, and she is the administrator of that office. That office is charged with furthering the department's mission and goals through close collaboration with our external stakeholders, through close collaboration with you, both inside and beyond the realm of public safety. This office manages all of our internal communications, our external communications, our media relations. So when you see a positive story in the newspaper, they get the credit. When you see that negative story in the newspaper, I get the credit. But this office manages all of those difficult conversations. They also ensure that we are as transparent, communicative, and open as possible. And that's something that's really important to me. So I want to thank Ms. Craig and her team for helping us engage in that openness and transparency. But I also want to thank them for their stellar work preparing us for this session, including the presentation that you will hear this week. Now, our internal audit unit lets us know how we're doing. I believe that they are such an important part of our agency because they allow us to mitigate our risks and ensure that we're operating efficiently. This is so important because I'm going to talk about later some of the audits that they've actually worked on that have actually improved our operations. Adrienne O'Connor is the administrator of that office, and she does a spectacular job ensuring that we're mitigating our risk to the best degree that we can. Now, I mentioned the oversight of the Office of the Inspector General. That office provides oversight function on behalf of the director and deputy director of the department. And as the former Inspector General, the current Inspector General, Leonard Williamson, does a fantastic job in this regard. The unit conducts internal investigations involving staff, inmates, contractors, volunteers, cooperates with law enforcement on all of our criminal investigations, and also conducts inmate hearings for conduct violations, and overall just ensures compliance with all of our rules, policies, and procedures. Each year, they investigate over 1,000 cases. One other function of this office is oversight with regards to our PREA efforts. PREA stands for the Prison Rape Elimination Act, which was passed by Congress in 2003. The PREA standards were released in 2012, and I am proud to say that we have passed our first national audits. We also just received a $500,000 grant to update our offender management system and to provide victim advocacy as part of the new PREA standards. Oregon Corrections Enterprise is...
Excuse me, Director.
Yes.
Representative Wisnett.
Ms. Chair, Director, thank you, Ms. Chair. Director, are we going to hear more about the internal audits and Office Inspector General? I heard what you said quickly, but I don't understand why we need two, why, you know, the audits couldn't be under the Office Inspector General. So we're going to hear more about that. I don't want to mess your chain.
Co-chairs, Representative, you will hear in more detail. I can explain quickly the difference, however. The internal audits function is different in that they go out and don't always necessarily go out and audit something that we suspect might not be functioning effectively. They go out and test to see if it is functioning effectively, where the Office of the Inspector General actually responds to specific allegations.
I'll look forward to that.
Okay, great. Now, Oregon's Corrections...
Director, can I ask you a question? How many internal auditors does DOC have?
It is a very small staff of three. Oregon's Corrections Enterprise is a semi-independent agency whose administrator reports directly to me, serves at my pleasure, and is a member of the Department of Corrections Policy Group, which is our executive cabinet. We are intricately connected, and our two missions really go hand in hand. Established in 1999 through the passage of Ballot Measure 68, it is the prison industry's component of our organization. And it plays an important role in helping us achieve our mission because we know that meaningful work opportunities and job preparedness contribute to that successful reentry. I would like to thank the new administrator.
Senator Winters.
Just a question. Will we hear more in depth from Prison Industries as to the types of work that's being done and how many and some of those?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, you'll actually get to hear more about that from me today.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
I'll save my question.
Fair enough. I would like to publicly thank Ken Jeske, who's the new administrator of OCU, who has come in and done a fantastic job of really shoring up those operations following what you all know was some incredibly intense scrutiny by the press. Now I will move to the next slide. The Department of Corrections is responsible for the care and custody of 14,000 offenders in 14 institutions throughout the state. These are individuals who have been convicted of felonies and sentenced to more than 1 year in custody. If they receive less than 1 year, they will serve their time in a local jail. In the last two calendar years, we processed more than 10,000 intakes and released about 10,000 offenders back into the community. In my mind's eye, that's 10,000 opportunities to really improve public safety and ensure that those individuals do not create a new victim upon release. As you know, Senate Bill 1145 allows counties to opt out and transfer community corrections back to the state. So we have two counties that have done that. Lynn and Douglas counties are managed by the state, supervising about 2,500 offenders in the community. So in addition to that direct oversight of those two counties, we also have indirect oversight of more than 30,000 offenders on felony probation, parole, and post-prison supervision through the administration of the Community Corrections Grant Program.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the directly supervise of in Douglas and Lynn counties, what exactly is your role there? Do they have county employees that you supervise, or do you have your own employees there? I'm not quite clear on that.
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, they are actually state Oregon Department of Corrections employees. They used to be county employees, and then those two counties opted out, if you will, through the mechanism afforded to them in 1145, and now they are state employees.
Hello. So you have to do all the HR and all the other stuff for these employees in their locations where they're at in those two counties, not in any of your correction facilities.
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, that is correct.
One last follow-up.
Follow-up.
Is that a difficulty? I mean, as I try to envision that across the state, if this grows, the ability to continually supervise people in a diffuse geographic area for HR and healthcare issues and all that stuff that has to be done for people, it seems to me that would become pretty daunting.
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, it would be. There's no doubt. We had to add additional resources even when we brought on these two counties. If additional counties proceeded to opt out, it would require additional resources. You're going to hear more later this week from Assistant Director Jeremiah Stromberg, who will talk in more detail about our function and our partnership with the counties in community corrections. But you're absolutely correct. It would require additional resources.
Mr. Chair, just to kind of add, and I think my concern, we do have those two that opted, and I certainly would not like to see more opt out. And based on, you know, all the work that we did for justice reinvestment, you know, we made some commitments, and I'd certainly like us to keep those commitments that we made, because it does tie in to the work that's being done in our communities or counties around the state. And so, you know, I don't know how many of you were around when we actually did 1145 and developed the community correctional coordinating councils and the commitment that was being made by the state, so that the counties would assume those responsibilities. And later we kind of reneged then on some of our pledges and promises that we make. And to me, I hope we don't go back there again. Just for the record.
Okay. Well taken.
So now that we've talked about who we are and what we do, I'd like to turn our attention to the adults in custody. Like the rest of the nation, the majority of offenders in our custody are men. They make up about 91% of our prison population. And while women make up just 9% of our inmate population, the female population is rising. In fact, since July 1, 2011, our female population has grown by 14% compared to 13% of growth in the male population. The good news is that we were able to temper the growth of female inmates through public safety reform and House Bill 3194. Pre-3194, we were projected to have 1,414 women in custody over the next 10 years, additional women in custody over the next 10 years. Post-3194, we are projected to have 1,300 women in custody. So that's a 6% decrease based on House Bill 3194. A breakdown of the types of most serious active offenses that resulted in DOC custody shows here that the majority are person-to-person crimes. When you look more closely at the person-to-person crimes, you'll find that more than a quarter of our population is incarcerated due to a sex crime.
What percentage of those are male versus female?
Do we have that breakdown on gender?
91%. Male, 9% women.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Williamson.
What kinds of offenses do your women inmates commit in order to do we have that breakdown anywhere?
So co-chairs and women? Senator Winter, we don't have that today, but we can follow up and get that back to you. What you'll see, the dramatic difference that you will see is that very few women come to the Oregon Department of Corrections having committed a sex crime, where the male population, a quarter of the adults in custody are there because of the male adults in custody are there because of a sex crime. What you'll see the majority of our women with are either drug crimes or property crimes supporting that substance abuse.
Follow up.
Director Peters, you and I have talked about this a lot, the capacity at Coffee Creek and where we're going, and I don't know if I'm getting ahead of you in this presentation, but I'm wondering if you could share with the committee some of the conversations we've had about where we are with our female population, how it's growing, and what how does that impact the future of this organization?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. It certainly is an issue at hand. We will be receiving the population forecast here in the coming weeks, and we'll work to truly understand what that will mean for the Department of Corrections. But Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, which is our female correctional facility, which hopefully all of you will be visiting on Monday, is over capacity. Now, we've managed temporary and emergency beds at that prison like we have all of our other prisons, but our fear is that the population forecast that's about to be released will actually involve an increase in what we projected we would have for female offenders. And so, and I will look to our CFO here, who I know will have his numbers, the numbers at his fingertips, but it's quite possible that that forecast could move up our need to open OSP minimum to accommodate that growth in female inmates, which unfortunately would impact then the cost avoidance dollars available for our Justice Reinvestment Initiative.
Madam Co-Chair, for the record, Rick Crager, Chief Financial Officer for Department of Corrections. Director Peters is absolutely correct. We're starting to analyze the numbers. Obviously, they're not finalized at this point. What we're seeing is right up to threshold in terms of what would take get to the point of activating a new prison site, which at this point we've targeted the Oregon State minimum as the targeted location. Again, we're still looking at those numbers very closely. The fear that we have, though, is based on the projections we're at right now, is everything is operating about 20 to 30 inmates more than what the forecast is coming in. So again, even if the forecast is right up against the threshold, history is showing that our women are actually slightly higher, which would put us in a situation to need to activate.
So 3194 impacted our male and female populations differently. Can you speak to that a bit?
Madam Co-Chair, I don't know that I could in great detail, okay, but we can certainly provide that information for you. I think because what I can say generally is because aside from short-term transitional leave, which really is the majority of the reform that 3194 enacted, the rest of the reforms really had to deal with low-level property and drug offenders, which, as I mentioned earlier, impacts one way or another more dramatically the female population.
Well, it was my understanding that the way we dealt with identity theft in 3194 did not have the impact we thought it would have on the female population because of the way that that crime is accounted for lack of a better term. And so there's a that we made assumptions about how identity theft would be dealt with in 3194 that have not bared out.
That's correct, right, Madam Chair. So what we assumed is that we would be able to lower the minimum from 24 months to 18 months for those identity theft charges. And in reality, what happened is the judges didn't deem that enough accountability. And the one thing that we didn't project for is that individuals don't end up before a judge having committed only one identity theft. It's often hundreds.
It's not really worth it.
That's
at that point.
Right. That's it exactly. And so we could then see why the courts deemed that 24-month minimum justified.
Right.
Senator Winters.
Thank you. In a part of your getting back to us on this particular issue, can you also share with us what parts of the counties that you're seeing that differential, whether it is Multnomah, Clackamas, what one of those counties, when we start drilling down into the data, because that would also be helpful with some of the assumptions that we made when we did 3194. You know, I knew when we first started implementing 3194, and the data started coming back. We did have some conversations with some of the courts and some other parts of the state, so that educational piece took place, so that everyone was actually operating on the same page. So it would be helpful to get those pieces of information as well.
Certainly, co-chairs and Senator Winters, just for clarification, would you also like that data to include the gender breakdown?
Yes.
Great.
And if you could please get that to Linda and she can distribute it.
Certainly. Mr. Co-Chair, we will get any follow-up information that the committee asks for today. We'll run all through.
Doing the spirit of what we did.
Linda.
Thank you.
Thank you. So as I mentioned earlier, our offender population is aging. While the percentage of those younger than 30 is showing a steady decline, those over 45 are growing rapidly. We've seen an increase of 34% in those 46 and older since 2006. And this has had a profound impact on our cost of health care. The 61 and older group is actually our highest cost group, while then the 18 to 24-year-olds are our least. A recent Pew study found that Oregon has the largest percentage of inmates over 55 in the nation. And I think it's important to note that generally, because of the lifestyles that they've lived, when an individual comes to the Department of Corrections, their body is actually 10 years older biologically than their chronological age. I think both because of lifestyle and that lack of preventative care. So in addition, I think it's important to note that following legislation both in 2013 and 2014, DOC and OIA have worked with counties to encourage the direct transport of youthful offenders to OIA rather than making a brief pit stop at DOC's intake facility. So I mentioned that so that you know we're attempting to think about those younger offenders in a different way as well. Unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, like the rest of the nation, Oregon has a disproportionate number of minorities in our criminal justice system. So African Americans represent about 3% of Oregon's population, yet they comprise about 9% of our prison population, so almost three times more inside our prison walls. Hispanics comprise 11% of Oregon's population, and in prison they're represented at a higher rate at 13%. American Indians comprise less than 3% of our prison population, yet they are incarcerated at a rate three times the population in Oregon.
Mr. Chair. Representative Wisnett. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, I missed the relationship with the black population versus what was the population?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnant, it's three. In Oregon, African Americans comprise 3% of Oregon's population, yet inside the prison walls, it's 9%.
Follow
so
up.
Three times more.
Follow Thank up. You. Do you track a Muslim population?
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnant, I do not believe that we do.
No, we don't.
I believe that we base all of our data collection on the census data so that we can do a comparator to that, to the U.S. Census.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
Because I am concerned about this disproportionality, not only in DOC, but also it exists in OYA, and it also exists in our foster care system. So all of our systems have the problem. And so I've been meeting with the directors of those particular agencies to look at this particular problem because it's systemic. And I met with the one of the individuals with the Black Commission today to ask the commissions to begin to take on and delve into this this issue as well. It's not something that I think that we could, if we look at it, can be proud of in Oregon, and that we've got to figure out the problem. And you know, and I shared with the young man today that Director Colette has to accept that all those who are sent to her, that's the same way with OYA and others. So, it, you know, it's not her issue, it's issues that are taking place in the community and at the front end. So, you know, I need to put that on the record just in case someone thinks that Colette's keeping them in there longer than what they have been sentenced to.
Thank you, Senator.
Well taken. And a reminder, Senator Winters played a key role in helping us pass, along with Representative Barker and a lot of members in the House as well, the racial impact statement legislation last session.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Krieger.
Colette, what can you attribute that to? I mean, I've talked to Judge Nan Waller, who's been in my office many times, and we are looking at education, health care, jobs as far as employment, family status, and those type of things. Is any of that have a bearing on this disproportionality?
Co-chairs and Representative Krieger, I wish I knew the answer. I think there's a lot of research out there that focuses on communities, focuses on the economy, focuses on education, et cetera. I think there is other research out there that looks at our implicit bias in the criminal justice system. So there's a whole lot of opinions out there. I don't know that one research paper has moved above others. But I will say that nationally, when people look at combating this issue and really trying to understand it and make change, one of the things that is touted is the bill that Senator Shields just mentioned around requiring a racial impact statement, both for any time there's a change in public safety sentencing and also with the Department of Human Services.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Kochev. I know that this is the state level, and so this is DOC, but are the figures comparable for the jail system in the state?
Co-chairs, representative, I don't know for certain, but we can look at that and provide a comparator for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just follow up. I think the length of stay may be different. And when you drill into some of the data, the jail versus DOC, but remember the length of stay determines the sentencing amount, and, you know, we can – I don't want to get into some of the technical pieces that I talked to the young man about, but, you know, it's the issue actually of whether you're plea bargaining and how many charges are stacked up on charges and some of the other tools that are used to where one group can stay in longer than the other. So we've got a lot of work to do. And to your question on causes, I think they're all of them, including when you figure that you've got the highest unemployment rate among black youth in not only in Oregon, but in the U.S. You look at the dropout rate in education. You start looking at all these factors that are there in communities, including the biases. So, yeah, I think they all play a part.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you see the same disproportion in women incarcerated?
Co-chairs and Senator, I am not certain about that. So we can look and see if that is. I know that the numbers that I shared with you are for all 14,500 right. adults in our custody. So we'll look at the female population more specifically.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick follow-up. Uh-huh. We're having a couple of profiling bills come through from the House to the Senate. And some of the anecdotal stories that are associated with those are very troubling, not from a prison point of view, but from the point of view of the judicial process. We know of several cases where two people were involved in really a minor crime together. The person was African American, got 30 days in the county jail, and the white person got nothing. And they were both there at the same time, did the same thing exactly. And the white person admitted and said, this is not fair, but it went forward. And that was in a very progressive part of our state called Ashland, Oregon. And when it can happen there, it can happen, I imagine, anywhere at a much more severe level. So this is not really a prison problem so much as a problem before they get to prison, obviously.
Thank you, Senator.
All right, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So we have now become the largest mental health care provider in the state. Approximately 70% of the adults in our custody have some form of mental health need, as you can see in this pie chart. So while keeping them safe, while keeping the other adults in custody safe and our staff safe, our philosophy around behavioral health is about engaging those adults in custody to teach them to take responsibility for their own health care and, specific to this issue, their own mental health care. We really view this environment as their practice ground to learn how to manage their mental health systems and manage their daily activities of simply living. So this is part of our self-management model, and that's really what we're trying to accomplish. We're really trying to create a health engagement model so that when they leave our care and custody, they are able to take care of themselves. The same is true regarding substance abuse. A large portion of our population is diagnosed with a substance abuse issue and would benefit from alcohol and drug treatment. However, the agency doesn't have the capacity or the resources to offer all those who have a need with treatment. So while 71% of our offender population has some substance abuse issue, at any given time we have 497 alcohol and drug treatment vets. I talked about how we're managing our performance. So in addition to CORE, Correctional Outcomes Through Research and Engagement.
I'm sorry to slow you down so much.
Not at all.
How many beds you say you had for drug and alcohol and mental health?
For drug and alcohol, it was 497.
And when they go into that treatment program, how long are they there?
Co-chairs, I apologize, I didn't go through you to answer that last question. Co-chairs and Senator Bates, it varies depending on the program. But we can provide you a list of all of our alcohol and drug treatment programs and then share those data points with you.
Representative Williamson.
You need to follow up?
I mean, it's so obviously an aha here. 71% drug and alcohol.
Right.
I got 58% mental health. That's the problem.
And we've known for a long time.
Yeah, it's the catch-all of a bunch of broken systems.
And Director Peters, you might want to explain also a little more in depth about mental health, because you also do have, in addition, because of your work and created where you have those who are severely mentally ill, where you can separate them from the rest of the population. So you actually have, not only those that are not so bad, it's all bad, I should rephrase that. But you do have several steps inside of the institution that you're dealing with to try to address the problem of the mentally ill. And we've talked about this because you're having to take on some new skills and some new programming that traditionally has not existed within the prison environment. So I think you need to share with this committee, because they pose some new challenges that may or not have they've had to deal with in years past. Is that a good way of phrasing it?
Co-chair, Senator Winters, no doubt it is. Respond? And so we have done so many things at the Department of Corrections to not only become the largest mental health provider, but one of the best mental health providers. And we are really doing that, as the Senator pointed out, focusing on those who are seriously mentally ill, allowing a special unit for those individuals who often would be in that revolving door of our disciplinary segregation unit. So really creating a more treatment environment for those individuals to be more proactively manage their behavior. We've also, and there are so many things that I could talk to you about, but the other one that I will highlight, we've also engaged mental health professionals now in the hearing process. So if you have someone who has a mental health issue and they have misbehaved while in the prison, the mental health professional actually gets to weigh in on what that behavior modification should look like. So we are trying to grow and evolve with best practices as it relates to what can be our most difficult population.
Representative Williamson.
Colette, I'm wondering if when you do the cut of the slide back, that one, if we have those numbers based on gender as well.
Madam Co-Chair, I do not have those today, but we'll get those to you.
That would be great. Thank you.
Certainly.
And then, Colette, could you also email to us what's considered a mental health diagnosis? Is it, I mean, there are certain diagnoses that are kind of associated with being in prison generally, like antisocial personality disorder, whereas, you know, depression or other diagnoses might not, would be more what people would think traditionally as mental health disorders.
Mr. Co-Chair, thank you for not testing me today. We will get you that. We will get you that lineup through email. Thank you,
Representative Gorsuch, and then Senator Bates.
Just thank you, Mr. Chair. It was in terms of your beds for substance abuse. Was that 497 beds?
496, Representative.
Across the whole system.
Or was it 97? It was 97.
And that's across the whole system.
497. Okay. That is across the whole system.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
Just want to remind you, you're supposed to get 8 hours sleep every night and work out at another time other than 4:30 in the morning.
Co-Chair, Senator, thank you. I have adjusted my lifestyle.
I got the message to never go to the gym.
Yeah. I like that.
Co-Chairs, that was not the message I was trying to deliver.
I heard it loud and clear. I'm sorry.
Delivered. Please continue.
So back to managing performance. In addition to CORE, our Correctional Outcomes Through Research and Engagement, there are actually a number of tools that we're using to measure our performance. As I said, we want to be as effective, as efficient, as progressive, and as important, as transparent as possible. You, in 2003, passed Senate Bill 267 requiring evidence-based and cost-effective programs. The prison and community programs that must comply with Senate Bill 267 are the alcohol and drug treatment programs we just talked about, also our cognitive change programs, and our parenting skills training. Traditionally, we have used the Corrections Program Checklist, which is a nationally recognized methodology for evaluating our effectiveness of treatment. In 2012, however, during the height of budget reductions, together, I think we made some of our, what I refer to as our best bad choices, as part of the statewide mid-management reductions, and we actually eliminated the positions that evaluated DOC programs. That's the bad news. The good news is you'll actually hear from Assistant Director Jeremiah Stromberg later this week about how we've worked with our county partners to add back capacity in this area. Here's where we'll talk a little bit more around internal audits. As I said, they really are an essential tool that helps us mitigate risk. They're able to go out there and look at programs and look at areas of our agency and determine if they're running appropriately and in compliance with our policies and procedures. Since 2011, that small staff of three that I mentioned earlier has conducted 29 audits. These include compliance, financial, performance and operational audits of various functions throughout the agency. The department has also helped other agencies with audit and reviews, so that small team actually engages in shared resources with other agencies in need. This slide lists examples of audit work recently completed. And I want to highlight one, the safety program audit. This audit looked at the status of our safety programs since the elimination of our safety managers in 2012, again, some of our best bad choices, but we eliminated all of our safety managers due to budget cuts. Our auditors recommended the department's administrator required training, implement better documentation, and improve the overall safety environment. So after the audit was performed, policy group saw those audit recommendations and actually assigned someone in our agency to provide that centralized oversight for safety. We rely on external audits. We use the Secretary of State's office for that function. The detailed information that you see here that might be hard to read in your handouts is provided as an appendix, however. In 2012 and 2013, the Department of Corrections was part of the statewide CAFR audit, which expresses an opinion on whether the financial statements contained in the State of Oregon's comprehensive annual financial report were fairly presented in all aspects and in conformity. Now, I am proud to report that the Oregon Department of Corrections received a gold star several years in a row for our good financial reporting. So not only were there no errors, we actually have received the gold star award many years in a row. The Secretary of State completed an audit on the treatment of high-risk released offenders to determine whether the benefits can exceed costs. We've talked to many of you about that audit when it was released. So as a result of that audit, we added a program evaluator position to evaluate both institution and community-based programs and provided assistance to counties through peer reviews and compliant audits. Last, I want to point out that at the time I appointed Ken Jeske to the head of Oregon Corrections Enterprise, our prison industries program, our internal audits conducted a change of administrator review. You will remember that I had to terminate the employment of that administrator, and so we wanted to conduct a change of administrator audit. They modeled their audit after the one that the Secretary of State often does when directors or administrators leave their positions. The scope of the audit included a review of the former administrator's employment history, access to assets, access to computer systems, travel and reimbursements, payroll and severance, and also contracts. Auditors found no issues within all areas except for the contracts piece. They found irregularities in each of these contracts, in each of three contracts with with the former administrator during the last 90 days of his employment, specifically with sitting OCA advisory council members. So the Secretary of State then reviewed that even further and has just recently issued their findings, which I know is available on their webpage. OCE Administrator Ken Jeske used this opportunity to reset the advisory board. So we have all new members on that advisory board. He revisited several of its policies in regards to contracts, donations, and all of those advisory board members now understand their fiduciary responsibilities and potential conflicts of interest.
Clint, the OCE and its makeup, is that statutory or is it constitutional?
Co-chairs, I believe it is constitutional, but let me follow up and get that. I'm fairly confident it is, but I'll get confirmation on that. Thank you.
Thank you. And one last question. The three contracts, were they related to the work performed by OCE, or were they employment contracts? What were the nature of these contracts?
Mr. Co-Chair, the nature of these contracts had to do with projects or assignments that then the OCE advisory board members, while they made the recommendation as an advisory board member, then was the personal recipient of those contract dollars from OCE.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Bates.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'd like to go back up to just above that last discussion, and treatment of high-risk offenders can avoid costs. The question rings to me is that knowing we have plus 70% of people leaving the facility are there because of or are associated with a drug and alcohol problem. What kind of a handoff is there when they leave the prison and try to go to a coordinated care organization and actually get a treatment program? People who are not in the correction system have a difficult time accessing drug and alcohol treatment programs. If we don't have enough of them, frankly, many times they aren't very well run. We're trying to work on those issues right now, this other budget issue. What's it like for somebody leaving here who is at high risk of coming back into prison? They leave the prison, I can just see them going right back into drugs or alcohol problems within days or weeks of getting out if they don't have support and pick up right away. What's that actually like? What actually happens?
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, first I will say, inside the prison walls, because we know that so many individuals have that need, we really do focus on those individuals that have the highest potential to reoffend in the community. You are absolutely right. That first 30, 60, 90 days is so important for those offenders as they enter back into the community that they're left with treatment. What I will tell you is we have evolved substantially over the years in terms of our partnership with community corrections, engaging in reach-ins so that they know what type of offender is coming to their community so they can get resources lined up for them. Like prison, you know, because you just said it, there aren't enough resources in the community. I think this is an exciting time because of the healthcare expansion. I think the national research says 99.9% of those in prison in this country will be eligible for Medicare or Medicaid following the expansion of healthcare. And so while I think the resources are not fully there now, I think this notion that they would be eligible for treatment the day that they're released, we could see a substantial impact in public safety because of that. But we're not there right now.
Senator Winters.
You might want to add that the enabling legislation that we passed and how many of the releasees are signed up with the Oregon Health Plan and to the CCOs before as they come out of the system, because we passed that enabling legislation to allow for a smoothest transition going back into the community. I think it was, I can't remember the number, but anyway, so we did get a report. The Department of Corrections and the Oregon Health Authority have been working really closely together to make certain that they're getting them enrolled, signed up, and ready out the door. And I can't remember, but I believe that we were talking about somewhere in the 90s that percentage were actually being enrolled.
So they're at least signed up.
At least signed up.
But then there's no treatment necessarily just because they're signed up.
Co-chairs and
first
Senator Winters
step.
And
good
Senator
step.
That's the first step.
Good step.
That is absolutely correct. Those numbers continue to grow. I don't have the most recent numbers of those that are signed up on their way out of prison, but I will certainly get those for you. Thank you. As I mentioned earlier, we have one of the lowest recidivism rates in the country at 28.8%. And as you heard earlier from the Criminal Justice Executive Director, Mike Schmidt, when he presented to this committee in February, House Bill 3194 added definitions of recidivism to include any arrest, any incarceration, or conviction within 3 years after a release from prison or within 3 years from a conviction. Key performance measures. This is your ability to ensure that we're managing to the level that we should be at the Department of Corrections. While these key performance measures have historically reflected the mission, vision, and values of the agency, as we engage in this conversation around CORE, our correctional outcomes through research and engagement, I would like to offer up the possibility of potentially changing some of these KPMs so that they line up with our map and what we're measuring at the Department of Corrections. So if you could be open to that conversation in the future, I think we will have some ideas for you. Ballot Measure 17 requires inmates to engage in work, programming, or education 40 hours per week. This is one of the areas where we are working to improve. We are in the red. At 66% compliance, we want to at least reach 80% as our target. Our ultimate goal would be that. Because we know that meaningful work and job skills training is that important component to that successful transition into the community. So one of the challenges we face is simply resources. There are only so many job opportunities inside our 14 institutions. So budget issues have also limited the number of work crews that we can send out. I shared earlier that OCE is working to increase the number of inmates they can employ and have already increased that number by 12% since 2012. So we're hoping that we will be able to improve the number of work crew opportunities and the number of opportunities at OCE. You will see this little bubble up here, CORE. I want to point out that that actually coincides with the measures back to our CORE map, so the OM-11A, OM-11B, that isn't a foreign language. That actually lines back up with our outcome measures here on this map for your interest. We are in the green on this, and as you can see, that bubble is there. This is also a CORE measurement. This is the percentage of high and medium risk inmates that complete a program prioritized in their correction plan. Again, this is an important one because if they're engaging in programming and treatment, they will make a new and better citizen upon release. We are in the green on recidivism. I would hope that would be the case since we're leading the nation in one of the lowest recidivism rates in the country. So you'll see here that we have a recidivism rate at 25.7%, yet I just told you our recidivism rate was 28.8%. So I want to tell you why this is different. I want to point out that all of our KPMs are for fiscal year 2014. So that's why this number is different, and I wanted to just make that clear in case it jumped off the page at you. We are also in the green on successful transitional leave. That includes short-term transitional leave, which you know now has expanded from 30 to up to 90-day period, and also our alternative incarceration program. We are in the green on assaults on staff, yet I want you to know that one assault on my staff is one too many. We know we work with some of Oregon's most dangerous individuals, many of whom have mental illness, as we talked about earlier, and we never want to see our staff get hurt. Unfortunately, we do. So we train our team in de-escalation so they can try and diffuse those situations before they become violent. That's our hope, is actually to prevent it. But when de-escalation doesn't work, we've trained staff in defensive tactics to help protect them. Again, if we're able to prevent these assaults, we hope that that will increase the staff wellness, because being assaulted or having a fellow colleague assaulted leads to that notion and that state of hypervigilance. So there are two performance measures on this chart. We're in the green on work crew walkaways. On average, the department has approximately 300 adults out on work crews on any given day. The department is well below the target of one per month. However, we did just experience a walkaway from our Two Rivers Correctional Institution, which you may have seen in the news in February. I want to assure you that that inmate has been taken into custody and was actually taken into custody the following day. We are in the red on the second performance measure. While escapes are rare within our secure custody facilities, minimum facilities, especially our unfenced minimums, pose a higher risk of inmates escaping. As you can see, this is the second area out of 13 where we are in the red, where we unfortunately had four escapes in fiscal year 2014. One involved an inmate climbing the fence at Columbia River, one of our facilities up in Portland, and one involved an inmate actually climbing the fence at our Deer Ridge Correctional Institution, and then two offenders actually walked away from our Mill Creek Correctional Facility. So there is, like staff assaults, there is no such thing as an acceptable escape. Each incident, I want you to be assured, was reviewed to identify why it happened, to determine if there was architectural or equipment failure, and what staff training issues needed to be addressed. We initiated measures in response to what we found to make change, and I want you to know that in those instances, we also rely heavily on the Oregon State Police and local law enforcement. But even recently, so I want to thank them for their help. Even recently, we've engaged with U.S. Marshal Berger, who has been a tremendous asset in helping us capture and bring back into custody walkaways, and I would also like to publicly thank him.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Director, how long was the inmate from Deer Ridge loose?
Let's see. Co-chairs and Representative Wisnett, the 3 weeks. I didn't have to do the math. Thank you, Mr. Krieger.
Just follow up. Any crimes and committed while he was escaped?
Co-chairs and Representative Winstant, there was a vehicle that was stolen, and I'm unfamiliar with what charges the individual gained when they were taken back into custody, but we can follow up and get that for you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Senator Bates.
Yes. You got 14,000 people incarcerated, right? You're talking 1 to 4. What do you expect? I mean, it's going to happen. They're high profile. Everybody talks about them, but the fact is, that's a rounding error. There's always a few people going to act out.
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, thank you for that sentiment. I appreciate that very much. Please be assured that I still will have a zero tolerance policy as it relates to walkaways. Thank you.
I feel that way about your kids, too, so that's okay.
That's right. Now, escape from our secure custody facilities are even rarer, fortunately. For this KPM, our target is zero, and we had zero escapes. So I really believe, because the good senator is right, we have individuals who are going to misbehave. We have some of the toughest individuals behind our prison walls. So I really give staff credit for their training and consistent application of good security practices are reflected in this high measure of achievement so that we can hold ourselves to that high standard. You can see here that this performance measure goes back to 2005. I want you to know we haven't had an escape from secure custody since 2001. And that was an escape from a Salem-based institution, our Oregon State Correctional Institution, where an offender concealed himself in the cargo of a vehicle. He will be with us for a very long time following that escape. The next performance measure, also one of our core measures, is the percent of total inmate care encounters that occur off-site outside of our prisons, and we continue to meet our goal. Because off-site visits are so costly, our health services staff is continually working on controlling the number of off-site medical trips so we are better able to manage the overall cost of delivering health care. While the graph is at the same size as the other graphs, I want you to know that what that graph is actually saying to you is less than 1% of the medical care that the adults in custody receive actually occur outside of our prison walls. So the super majority occur by our doctors in prison.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have one question for you. In terms of the targets that we see in the various graphs, where does the target come from? What data drives that target?
Co-chairs and representative, great question. I know that they have evolved over time. I can do a little look and look at the history as where and figure out where they began.
Okay. Thank
Certainly
you.
Happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Uh-huh. All right, we've got about another 10 or 12 minutes.
The next performance measure is the number of workers' compensation time lost per 100 days. We're in the green, so the only thing that I will point out is the dip that you saw there wasn't necessarily good news. It's consistency in our data collection. So we're back right up below the target, and we have actually created a more consistent way of tracking this. So we'll have even better data for you in the future.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Winters.
And that's of real interest. The stat. Do you know how you compare with the Oregon State Hospital? Because that's another one of the institutions that I have followed over the years. And I can see my good friends in the back because she knew probably I was going to ask that question. Do you have any comparable data with Oregon State Hospital? Can we get that? Linda, because hopefully those trends are also leveling off as well.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, I know the last time that we did the check, we had the honor of having the highest number of worker comps claims. So I know that comparative data is out there. I don't have it here today, but we will definitely follow up and get that to you. I'm very proud of this next key performance measure because it has dropped so dramatically. We are pleased. I am pleased around the progressive efforts led by one of our employees, Chad Nagel, who has embraced sustainability, as many of you have heard, because we've actually received some positive press around this. The conservation efforts at the Department of Corrections have been very progressive. Here we calculated on a BTU per square foot basis. The department has reduced our consumption of electricity and natural gas by 16.3% from our 2000-year calendar line. So we were proud to receive the March 2014 Mid-Willamette Valley Green Awards Recycler of the Year, also the Innovation in Sustainability Award from the Portland Business Journal, and also received the Governor's 2014 Sustainability Award. In the interest of time, co-chairs, as the following performance measures are all in the green, I didn't want to stop before the sustainability one because I'm so proud of it. Would it please the committee to move past the following key performance measures and move to the budget issues?
I think so, and get those started.
Thank you. I know that we were hoping to have my part of the presentation wrapped up today. You can see that in 13-15, some of the unspecified reductions taken during that cycle will carry into the 15-17 biennium. So, we're on the right slide. Of the $78 million in unspecified reductions, approximately $22 million in services and supplies are not restored in the governor's 15-17 budget. We also have additional e-beds. I talked about that earlier. We currently have 964 active emergency beds, far more than we would hope to have in this system. And our 10-year population management plan actually takes the majority of those offline. I mentioned PREA earlier, the Prison Rape Elimination Act. We passed our first 7 audits. That is not the fate of other states, so I want you to be proud of that as well. We did submit a $14.9 million policy option package that was not carried forward, but we will continue to maintain compliance within the budget we are given. You all saw this slide earlier when I was here presenting around cost avoidance. Based on the October 2014 forecast, with the full 3194 impacts, the estimated prison population will not trigger the need to construct the Junction City Prison in the 10-year period, and or nor the activation of the Deer Ridge Medium Facility until 2019-21. As I mentioned earlier, we will take a look at this incoming forecast and see what that impact means for the women in our custody.
Just for clarity, Mr. Chair, that's assuming that we continue to go forward as planned in 3194. I mean, it's should we deviate somehow, and should the reinvestment that we had planned for the communities, because the partnership is with DOC and our communities. I need to kind of put that on the record.
Thank you, co-chairs. Thank you, Senator Winters. That's absolutely correct. That assumes that 3194 moves forward as we had hoped. I will tell you those conversations with the local DAs, the local chiefs, the local sheriffs have been profound. We're having conversations now that we did not have before. We're looking at data now that we did not look at before. So it has been a really powerful engagement process. Thank you. This chart shows you that we are primarily a general funded agency at 95.7% of our budget. This slide outlines the 10% reduction options. Because none of those move forward in the 15-17 budget, in the interest of time, I am happy to move through that and answer any questions you might have about the 10% plan at another point. Quickly, these are the proposed pieces of legislation that the agency is bringing forward. Many of them are just cleanup bills. House Bill 2423 would make life sentences for murder and aggravated murder ineligible for sentence reduction. House Bill 2424 would clarify current statutory language that was imposed through our gun bill from last year, House Bill 4035. I want you to know that we've been working very closely with AFSCME and AOCE to move that piece of legislation forward, and I thank them for their collaboration. House Bill 2425 would authorize the Department of Corrections access to previous juvenile information. Senate Bill 232 would establish statutory authority for our agency to receive and expend grant funds for those individuals who are on community supervision. We currently don't have that ability. Senate Bill 233 would expand language of House Bill 2087. That was the bill that allows us to get Medicare and Medicaid for those individuals who are in hospital and out of prison for more than 24 hours. Senate Bill 234 repeals outdated and unnecessary statutory language surrounding the process of purchasing products actually manufactured by Oregon Corrections Enterprise. This is a cleanup bill. And so before I wrap up with just a mere 4 minutes to spare, I am proud to say for that the first time in Oregon Department of Corrections history, and I'll bring your attention to this slide, we fly an agency flag. We recently realized that we were lacking this distinctive symbol of pride. Many Oregon Department of Corrections have that symbol of pride. So the agency flag visually represents the department and our pride for the work that we do. The timing for the unveiling could not have been more momentous. I previously learned that we had done nothing to honor or memorialize the murder of Director Michael Franke. And so on January 16th, we actually presented this flag to the family of the former director during a ceremony at the Dome Building, where we dedicated a newly renovated conference room. Some of you have seen it already, in Mr. Franke's honor. So the photo that you see here is our honor guard commander to the left, Captain Lance Elbert, and to the right, Sergeant Rivacaba. And they're presenting the flag to the Mr. Franke's brother. So with that, I will conclude my portion of the presentation. I know that our team is excited to sit before you for the remainder of the week. I am happy, I say that seriously, Representative. I am happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Seeing none, thank you very much, Director. We appreciate your testimony. And anything else for the good of the order, Ms. Gilbert?
Nope.
Just DOC all week.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you so much. We'll see you tomorrow.
All right, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you so much. We'll see you tomorrow.
All week. Mm-hmm.